Thanks for downloading the Charlie Higson and Friends podcast, which originally broadcast on Scala Radio, a station where we have fun with classical music. It's home to Penny Smith, Simon Mayo, Mark Kermode, and me, Charles Nove. And you can find us on DAB Digital Radio, scalaradio.co.uk, and on the Scala app. Right, over to you, Charlie.
Welcome back to Charlie Higson and Friends here on Scala Radio. And my friend at the moment is Lucy Porter, and I hope we'll still be friends after this show.
It's only deepened the bond, I like to think. I've found out things about you that I could never have dreamt. Mostly, you know...
We won't go into that. No. This is what we've been talking about while the music's been playing. So Lucy, you got into stand-up in the 90s. Do you still tour a lot?
Yeah, so I do the Edinburgh Festival every year, and I write a new show, and then I sort of tour that around art centres and small theatres, modest-sized venues that'll have me, and I'm very grateful that they do.
So doing something like that, do you sort of concentrated work when you got the gigs coming up, or are you sort of all the time squirreling ideas away?
No, I'm quite lazy. So, I mean, I really work to deadlines. Mm. So the reason stand-up comedy works for me is that at some point you will have to stand on a stage in front of a room full of people and say something to them.
Yes.
And the thought of that is sufficiently terrifying.
I'd never grasped that. Shows you how much I know.
That is very much the nature of the job.
That is a gun against your head, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is. So every year I'm like 2 weeks before the Edinburgh Festival.
You 2 weeks? Yeah. All of 2 weeks?
Basically, my husband's like, have you still
God, that's
not?
A lot of funny stuff to write in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Well, I just pull all-nighters and I do, you know, it's like
and then, but then
again.
When you're doing a show like that, how much does it change and develop from one gig to another?
Yeah. And I mean, that again is the thing that I like about it, because I have a very short attention span. I mean, stand-up is a great gig if you've got, you know, short attention span, high self-confidence, low self-esteem, basically. Those are the kind of magic ingredients.
And what's your ideal length for a stand-up spot?
Oh, well, 40 minutes, I think, is the limit of human concentration. And I have done no scientific research into this, but I absolutely believe that to be the case. I think 40 minutes is absolutely spot on.
Sounds ideal to me.
Yeah, 2 40-minute halves I do. Mm. And then maybe, if they're lucky, at the end I'll do a song.
And do you have a sort of box of greatest hit or favourite gags that you will always pull out?
No, because my memory's terrible, completely gone. So yeah,
so
I mean,
don't go back and look at old shows and think, oh, I could do that bit.
No. I mean, like an idiot, I haven't preserved most of my shows. But that's what I kind of like about stand up as well, as the ephemerality of it. That, you know, like a great concert, or you know, you have to be there on the night, I think, to really appreciate it. And I love live arts for that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the most immediate thing you can do, and closest bond you can have with an audience, isn't it, really, that you're there saying stuff, and presumably sometimes you'll say something for the first time and think, well, let's see where this goes.
Yeah.
And instant feedback from an audience is...
I know, well, you know, like if you're doing telly or even radio, you have to wait to get commissioned, and then you have to wait for it to go on, and then, you know, people write to, in my case, normally Radio 4, and complain vociferously about whatever you've done. Whereas with stand-up, you know, it's out there and it's done. You write it in the afternoon, you do it in the evening, and then you're in the bar by 10:30. Ideal.
So let's have some music, Lucy. I asked you for a banger.
Yes.
And you've come up with Casta Diva from Bellini's opera Norma.
I do love it, and it was one of those that I just happened upon. It was on, there was some trendy Channel 4 youth programme when I was in my early teens, and they had some fashion item, and this was the piece of music that accompanied it, and I was stopped in my tracks by it, and of course said to my dad, what's this? And he was delighted. He was like, oh, I must play you Norma. And
so did you sing it to him, or do you remember it that well, or how did you find out what it actually was?
I probably did do a little warbling. You know, I'm no Maria Callas. I'm obsessed with Maria Callas. I think it's one of the great all-time stories. I think she's just... Has there been a biopic of Maria
Callas? There've been loads of... I mean, there's certainly been a lot of documentaries. And I'm sure there has been a dramatisation of some sort.
If not, Winona Ryder. That's who I'm saying she'd
Winona
play
Winona Ryder.
She'd be a good... Do you remember Joanne Wally Kilmer, who was in Singing Detective, which I watched again recently? She's a brilliant actress, and I've not seen her do anything for ages. Let's whack her on a Maria Callas movie.
We'd have to be later life in Maria Callas.
That's what I'm interested in, though. I'm not interested,
I'm not interested in young people at all.
No, I think you want. So you'd have her looking back,
right?
And then you'd have a young, you'd have like Millie Bobby Brown as the as the youthful one or something. I don't know young people, but I've heard of her.
But no, I mean that is probably a proper epitome of a diva, a proper epitome of a massive international star, isn't it?
And the whole point of opera to me is not only should it be about suffering, but the singer should suffer. I kind of think that you're not truly an artist if you're happy. So, you know, I love your Maria Callas's and your Edith Piaf's and, you know, people who've... Because you do, you bring that pain to your work, don't you?
Well, you've made me feel terrible now because I'm reasonably happy.
Are
I'm
you
thinking,
though?
That's it, I'm never going to sing opera. I'm never going to be the new Maria Callas.
I know, you are going to have to look for a... I mean, I'm certainly not casting you to play her in my movie. I'm sorry, Charlie.
Well, what about Onassis? I could do Onassis, I could do a comedy Greek accent.
Yeah. Well, we've heard your German and it's been incredible. So
yeah, it'd be kind of like a Stavros approach
Okay.
to being a Greek shipping magnate.
All right. You're in. You on a boat. That's what I can picture. But yeah, I do. I love her voice so much. It's amazing. Okay.
So this is Charlie Higgs and Friends on Scala Radio, and I am talking to Lucy Porter. And we've talked, Lucy, about how you got into stand-up in the 90s. And that presumably then opened lots of doors into doing other work.
Mm. Yeah, well, it was the time when panel shows were huge. So there was Never Mind the Buzzcocks and Have I Got News For You and What the Week and stuff. So I kind of had a little period of doing a lot of those, some of which were tremendous fun, some of which were like absolute torture, worse than ironing. And
do you want to talk about that or shall we move swiftly
on? Let's move swiftly on. I shall iron it out later.
I think I can know one of the shows you might be referring to.
But yeah, no. I was really lucky to get, very lucky to get on all of those things. And that, yeah, that kind of sort of was a crazy time of, it did feel like comedy had become the new rock and roll and it was all sort of early 2000s.
Yes. Well, I think what partly was happening was that TV companies had never known really what to do with stand-ups other than showing them doing their gig. So the idea of like, oh, we'll just put them together on a panel show and they can compete with each other for screen time.
Yes.
It's a good, cheap way of using them.
It is. And I mean, actually, stand-up is cheap anyway. So, you know, all those shows like Live at the Apollo and stuff, you go, yeah, it's enduringly popular putting comedians on telly because we are quite, you know, it's a person and a microphone and you don't need a big band and you don't need dancers and sets and things. So, there was a definite sort of heyday of that kind of comedy, which I was lucky enough to coincide with. And now I've slid off the screen and onto the radio a bit more.
Would you say you've sort of found a new home on Radio 4?
I love Radio 4, but I always have. And I think, I kind of feel, so I'm nearly 50, and I feel much more comfortable and at home with middle age than I ever did with youth. And I think I was quite miserable until I was well into my 30s. So
That's
Radio 4...
That's a long time to be miserable.
It was a long time to be miserable, yeah. I can look back and laugh now, and there were certainly high spots. But I like sort of quiet contentment and reflection. And, not that Radio 4, of course, isn't a dynamic, exciting station that appeals to the youthful demographic that
they're
always
chasing. Well, you see, this is the thing, because it often comes up that someone new controller comes in at Radio 4 and they'll look at the statistics and they'll say, well, no young people listen to Radio 4. We've got to make it more for young people. And you have to say to them, look, just sit down for a minute and think about this. Young people have got a lot of other things that they can listen to first, like Radio 1, although I'm not sure how many young people still do. But when they get older, they will listen to Radio 4.
Yeah.
You don't have to make Radio 4 cater to young people, because then the people who like Radio 4 won't want to listen to it anymore.
I did like it when I was young, and I used to listen when I was a teenager to all the comedy shows.
Yes, and Just a Minute. And
yeah, and the idea that they might then be trying to make something for me, I think I would have found a pool.
So have you managed to be on all those great Radio 4 shows that you listen to, so, like Just a Minute?
As many as I can, yeah. So Just a Minute is
Sorry I Haven't a
great
Clue.
Fun. Now, I haven't done Sorry I Haven't a Clue yet, but I shall be dropping heavy hints to the producer of...
Some of those shows are a little bit of a closed shop, aren't they?
Oh, but do you know what, though? That is such a lovely group of people.
Oh, yeah.
So I do feel, yeah, I don't resent being on that really, because they're all so lovely. And the, in fact, the producer of that also produces The Unbelievable Truth, which is one of my favourite ones
to do.
That's
a great show.
Because, you know, you get to write a ridiculous essay and tell lies. And in fact, and I did compete against my husband on that. We always said we would never work together because we thought we'd fall out, and it turns out we were absolutely right. We worked together on that, and it got really quite unpleasant, because lying to your spouse is one thing, but
was
doing
he able
it
to spot
radio?
Your lies?
No.
Were you able to spot his?
No. I mean, clearly we know nothing about
each other. Well, that's a marriage made in heaven, let's face it.
We're both blissfully unaware of the other's subterfuge and misdeeds.
Charlie Higson and Friends on Scala Radio.
So Lucy, one of the things I ask on this show is if people have a piece of music that they'd like to share with the audience who may not be as familiar with it.
Yes, so I, on coming on this show, I thought, oh gosh, do you know what? I'd really like to pick a piece of music by a female composer, because I think it's kind of important to represent women. And I sort of realised, oh my goodness, I don't actually know any. So I went out looking and this is what I found.
Okay. This is Improvisation number 2 in A Major by Amy Beach. And so tell us a bit about Amy Beach then.
So yeah, Amy Beach, she was a pianist, but also an incredibly successful composer. And she composed the Gaelic Symphony, which was the first symphony composed and published by an American woman. So she died in 1944. But so in the early 20th century, she was
quite a big deal. When was that symphony?
So 1896 was when the Boston Symphony Orchestra formed the Gaelic Symphony.
I mean, it is interesting that the great, the canon of what we call classical music, that there are only a tiny handful of female composers in there. I mean, I know it's the same in fine art and so many places, but it's also interesting that in the last 20, 30 years, a lot more female composers have come to the fore, particularly in composing for films,
and
that area, which is obviously, I think it's probably very hard to be a classical composer these days to make money.
Yeah.
So obviously the outlet of film, TV music is really useful.
Yeah, I've got a friend, Carly Paradis, who is a brilliant composer who does... She did Line of Duty.
Ah, right, yeah.
Which, you know, you do remember that sort of clanging kind of amazing introduction to that. And, yeah, I mean, she's doing brilliant work. And it's... I mean, you know, everything moves slowly, but it is... It's, you know, it's just very encouraging, isn't it?
Well, here's a quiz for our listeners. What was the first symphony composed by a woman that was performed in... the UK.
Ooh.
I'm putting out as a quiz for the listeners because I have absolutely no idea what the answer is.
And we don't have a prize either, but good luck with that, everybody. We'll come up with a prize. I've got a quite nice bookmark in my bag.
But that brings us around nicely. The fact that you are, and this is something that we bonded over when we met in 2022 in the Lake District, our shared love of quizzes.
Yes.
Pub quizzes, TV quizzes.
Yes.
The works. And you do a podcast about quizzes.
I do. It's called Fingers on Buzzers, and I present it with Jenny Ryan, who your listeners may know as The Vixen.
Well,
from
you
the
see,
Chase.
I do know The Vixen because when I did The Chase, I've managed to do nearly all of the TV quizzes, luckily, which I've loved doing. But I did it, and I had Basil Brush on my team.
Oh, lovely.
So inevitably... they put us up against The Vixen.
Of course.
But we won, actually.
Yeah.
Which was nice.
Quite a significant amount of money, I believe, as well, wasn't it?
I think it was, yeah. We had a good run.
Yeah.
Andy Peters sort of threw himself under a bus for us halfway through.
Bless him. I can imagine Andy Peters would do that.
Yeah, but the guy working at Basil Brush had a really tricky job because he had to lie on the floor behind the desk, stick Basil Brush up the top. He had to work Basil Brush. He had to say funny things for Basil Brush to say. And he had to work even though Basil had a buzzer, the actual buzzer, he was working with his knee on the floor whilst looking at a little monitor.
I mean, that's so doing five times
the work. For him to get even
one
question right was pretty amazing.
That is incredible, because you'd have to remember that Basil's got to press the buzzer at the same time that you're pressing
and you,
the
buzzer. And, you know, particularly on if it's the kind of first to the buzzer, he never got first to the buzzer.
No. I mean, I was on with Arge from Towie.
Right.
And he didn't have that excuse, but he never got first to the buzzer either. Right. So but he was a
did
lovely
you,
man.
Did you win on when you did the chase?
Well, I've done it twice, so I have won. Which was me, Krishnan Guru Murthy, Jay Rayner, and Steve Davis.
What a good
I love
lineup.
The weird, you know, combinations of people that you get, and they were all lovely, and we did very well on that one. And then I was on, and it was the Christmas episode. We filmed it in April.
The big Christmas.
We were
episode.
All wearing Christmas clothes around the Christmas.
Who was your chaser?
It was Mark that time. So we had Anne the first time, and then we had Mark.
Tough to beat.
Oh, really tough to beat. And we did, I mean, it wasn't a humiliating defeat, but it was quite humiliating because at the end, obviously, we've just lost all this money for charity and it's Christmas Day. And then they set off a sort of confetti cannon and we're all standing there looking absolutely bereft as the Christmas music plays. So, yeah, that, you know, I've won one, I've lost one. So I've experienced everything there is that life has to offer.
Are there any of the TV quizzes you haven't done that you really...
Well, I only did Eggheads recently, and I had been desperate to do that. I mean, only Connect, obviously, is the connoisseur's
Well, they don't
choice.
Do the celebrity ones anymore.
They used to,
They did, because I did two of them.
Did you?
We filmed them both in the same day. One was for Sport Relief and one was for Comic Relief.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so jealous.
It was great.
Yes.
Well, I think it's Emma Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
The actress.
She's great.
She actually went on as a punter to do it because
was
so keen
Mitch
to do it.
Ben,
she had a little team,
They
didn't do very well.
No, well, that's it. I mean, I would never go on the real versions of any of these because obviously the celebrity versions, they make the questions a lot easier, so you look a lot cleverer. Like University Challenge, I mean...
Yes. Well, there's probably more arts questions on University Challenge when they got celebrities on, less heavy science.
Yeah. They know that we're not
Unless
really going to be...
And a bona fide scientist on, I suppose.
Yeah, we were all very soft arts. Well, in fact, no, we had Christine Burns, who was brilliant. She's a computer scientist. But then it was Judge Rinder and Jesse Armstrong.
And how well did you do on University Challenge?
We did great. The first show, we did amazing. And we were like, this is the best thing ever. We're going to go to the final. We're going to win. And we were all really pally with it. We were like, we're going to be best friends forever.
And then you came up against an Oxbridge College.
And then, basically, I can't remember who beat us. But, and then we were like, let's never speak of this again. And we shall never see each other
again.
When
I did University Challenge, we did get to the final.
Oh, lovely.
And we were smashed to pieces by Rachel Johnson and her cronies from some Oxbridge College.
Yes.
But, yes, no, No, because I was talking to Victoria Corin Mitchell. No, actually, she said it on the show that they won't do any more Celebrity Only Connect because she thinks that... she rightly thinks that the ordinary people they have on are celebrities in their own right.
Yes,
and are much more interesting than us bunch.
I know. Well, actually, I think there is absolutely... She's bang on there that it's such a beautiful show. It is, and don't mess with it. Because, the other one is House of Games, which...
Yes. I did the pilot for that, actually.
Oh, you see, in at the ground floor with that. But everyone says, actually, now they should do a House of Games for... Non-celebrities, because people are desperate to do it.
But Richard would only do things with celebrities now. He's made so much money from his books.
He doesn't even need to work ever again, does he?
So, Lucy, we both have a shared love of quiz music, and that has influenced your love of Hans Zimmer.
It has.
Because it is a classic pub quiz question, isn't it, of us... And, well, it'll give away the answer now. It's who wrote the music for Going for Gold, which was the classic quiz show. Was that 90s or 80s?
I would say it was 80s. It was to do with whenever the Seoul Olympics was, because it was meant to be... It was just going to be win tickets to the Seoul Olympics.
And it was like a sort of Eurovision quiz show, wasn't it, of people all around Europe.
Yeah, the most desperately unfair situation where it was British people against people from England.
Who played Bridget in Coronation Street?
Yes.
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that one.
But they were so lovely and jolly, and it was... Oh, do you know what? It was, however you feel about Brexit, it was a time when Europe seemed more kind of close. Yeah. And
it was fun and chummy.
It was. It was a lovely show. And Henry Kelly was unbelievably good on that. And in fact, we interviewed him for our podcast and he is still just the most gorgeous man you've ever chatted to. So yeah, I loved Going for Gold. And that theme tune is an absolute banger.
Yeah, which was written by Hans Zimmer, who's now the biggest thing in film music, probably all music in the world now. And Lucy, we were talking about film music earlier, in the light of your love of Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence,
yes,
by Ryuichi Sakamoto.
That film that I can't get enough of.
Yes.
I've never seen.
But you have chosen now for another piece, which is actually from one of your favourite films.
Yes. So this is from The Apartment, and it's Adolf Deutsch.
Sort of classical Hollywood film music, which there's a sound there that instantly transports you into the glamour of being in the cinema and watching those films. Although I assume you've probably never seen The Apartment actually in a cinema.
I never have, but I would love to. And they do occasionally, they pop on at film festivals, so I will one day. But yeah, I love, and it is incredible the range of what he does in that movie, because it's all set around Christmas and New Year, and so there's sort of celebratory bits, and then there's, you know, for anyone who hasn't seen The Apartment, you absolutely must, because it's Billy Wilder at his finest and it's heartbreaking, and Shirley MacLaine and Jack Lemmon are just such an amazing couple, and very romantic, very sad, and also
funny as well
and hilarious,
which is, you know, is hard to pull off, but Billy Wilder was a master at that.
Those great last lines, you know, like shut up and deal in this one, or nobody's perfect from Some Like It Hot. So but beautiful music as well.
Jonathan Coe has written a great book about Billy Wilder and the relationship with his writer I.A.L. Diamond, which is about the making of Billy Wilder's last, I think it was his last film, Fedora. Unfortunately, not a great film, but it's a really interesting book, and it's about the relationship between a director and a writer who's worked on so many films together, and that really interesting relationship. And I believe Jonathan is writing a film script to that, and that's going to be a film, because I love anything about creative people, particularly writers, and it's very difficult to film that, because the process of writing is not a spectator sport.
No, it really isn't.
You sit there, and I mean, the old days when writers at least had typewriters, you could have the classic scene of them hammering away and tearing the paper up and screwing it and throwing it in the waste bin and missing, and then you see a pile of about 100 sheets of paper.
And they'd all be smoking as well, which again you couldn't do
and
nowadays.
And that is essentially apparently what the writing process is.
Little quiz question for you. Are there any movies, books or whatever about the collaboration between a composer and a director, or about scoring? Because that's a more interesting process to watch, isn't it? Is someone...
Well, yeah, because and you can actually hear the music.
Yes.
Which is a good thing.
Charlie Chaplin, I always think, is quite interesting in that respect, that he kind of was desperate to score his own... Because I think eventually... Was it Limelight? I think he wrote the music for Limelight, didn't he?
I think he might even have won an Oscar for it.
I think he might have done, you know. Mm. And... yeah, but that sort of, because he was such a kind of control freak, you sort of go, it was the last thing there to, I'm going to do the music as well, I'm going to do it all. But.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is something that is easier to put on screen, the writing of music, the development of music. Mm. When Hitchcock was making Rear Window, because James Stewart is looking into these different apartments and following different stories, directing, he wanted to do something which he said he never quite pulled off, which was at the beginning we start to see that there's a composer with a piano in one of the apartments, and he's starting to write a piece, and Hitchcock wanted to be at that without necessarily being aware of it. Each time we come back, he's written more of it, and it's growing, and then at the end, I think his plan was originally that he would hear the music on, you know, in a TV show or something that was on the TV.
Yeah, clever.
But he never pulled it off.
Never pulled it off. In The Seven Year Itch, is the guy in The Seven Year Itch a composer? I feel like he might be.
He does something creative, doesn't he?
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember.
So we're coming up to the final stretch here on Charlie Higson and Friends, and I've been really enjoying talking to my guest stroke friend today, Lucy Porter. We've got some of John Barry's fabulous music for James Bond. Without John Barry's music, would have been very different. And that was from Thunderball. It's a piece called Bond Below Disco Volante, And it's got all the great thing about it is it's got all the sort of you could call them cliches of what you put in for underwater music. Particularly, you have to have a harp.
Yes, 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 absolutely. I hear a harp. I see mermaids and yes. starfish and
fronds of seaweed, seagrass. But you know, as we're saying, you know, I think the music that John Barry brought to those films. Without that, I don't think those films would have lasted at all the way they did.
No, I mean, I really hated Bond for years and kind of it's only...
Well, I won't be having you back on the show.
No, no, but I've seen the light now. James Bond and the music of Queen are two things that I absolutely hated. And largely thanks to the influence of my husband, I've managed to come around to both of those. So, yeah, no, I love a Bond. And the kids absolutely love them. Absolutely love them. And you're right, the music is absolutely extraordinary. And and the clothes and the whole sort of mise-en-scène. I'm going to say mise-en-scène. I don't really know what it means. Yeah. But
yeah, well, you know, they invented that whole idea of the sort of big international thriller.
Yes.
For better or worse. But the reason I've played it is to tee up your next choice of music, which is some more water music.
A watery theme, it does. So, yes, I chose this. So it's Handel's Water Music. And I chose this because it has a very special place in my heart, because I included this in a sitcom that I wrote, which was called The Fair Intellectual Club. And I did one glorious series of it, and Radio 4 said, it's so good, we couldn't bear to have you dilute the genius of it by making any more of them, which I think was an artistic choice I respect.
What was it about?
It was actually based on a play that I'd written, which was based on a true story of a club called the Fair Intellectual Club, which was a group of girls in Edinburgh in the early 1700s who saw all the interesting things that their brothers and male counterparts were studying, because, you know, it's obviously the dawn of the Enlightenment and Edinburgh was a great seat of learning. And they were like, hang on, there's all this maths going on and there's all this science, and why do we just have to paint flowers on vases and learn how to look pretty?
And did you write it as a sitcom or as a drama?
No, I wrote
drama?
It as a drama.
Right.
And because they published a pamphlet, which was an amazing source material. So they published this kind of manifesto, essentially, saying this is who we are, this is what we want. And so I wrote a piece for three, because there were three founder members of this club, so I wrote a piece for three young actresses, which we did in Edinburgh, and that went well. And so then Radio 4 commissioned a sitcom off the back of it. So which, you know, obviously then it became more knockabout fun, and I decided that they would meet great figures of the day in each episode. So they, you know, they met Newton, and some of the time periods were a little bit dicey, but they did, they met Handel, and it was the idea was that Handel was lacking inspiration. You know, he's kind of fallen out with George the First, and
he's lost his mojo,
come up with some amazing piece of music for this concert on the Thames, and they inspire him with their learning and their philosophy and their general sort of intellectual heft. So it was quite a sweet thing to write. And of course, it being a sitcom, I got one of my friends in to do a comedy German accent, which if I'd known you could do it so well, I would have booked you for it.
Ladies, you've given me a great idea.
Yes!
I shall write some water music.
Yes. That's very much how it went, yes. And so then it's just a lovely sort of end. You always end on a song, and if you can end on Handel, I mean, what could be better?
And inspired by that, I've chosen as my last piece of music some music that I used on The Fast Show.
Oh.
Now, the great thing about making programmes for the BBC is that they have a blanket copyright agreement for music, so you can, up to a point, use any music you like without having to pay vast sums of money for it. So one of the things I enjoyed doing on The Fast Show was putting in, using great bits of music. And the characters of Ted and Ralph were unexpectedly popular with the with the audience. And we did a scene where Ted is trying to teach Ralph how to fly fish. Mm-hmm. On the on a riverbank, and as we know from Gone Fishing. Paul Whitehouse is a very keen fisherman.
Yes.
And as we know from Gone Fishing, he sort of gets so involved in the fishing, he forgets he's making a television programme, which slightly happened when we were filming this sketch where he's trying to teach me and he just wanted to actually fish for himself. But Ted is telling an anecdote about how when he was younger there was a burning building and he went in to rescue a small boy.
Oh, yes.
And so we needed some music that was sort of slightly eerie and would slightly sort of do that sort of dissolving back in time type music that they used to do. Going back to the John Barry using harps.
Yes, exactly, the classic harp flashback.
Yes, it's that sort of watery. So Arvo Pärt, who wrote a cantus in memory of Benjamin Britten, would never have expected that his music would be used in a cheap comedy sketch. But this is the music we used. Arvo Pärt wrote for the Farce Show. He didn't realise it at the time. The punchline of the sketch was Ted goes away and Ralph is thinking about this story. And he goes, oh, it was me, wasn't it? And Ted says, no.
Oh, lovely.
Well, I have so much enjoyed talking to you and finding out more about you and making proper friends with you.
Oh, do you know, it's been an absolute delight. And I feel relaxed by many of your choices. I feel invigorated by the crazy clanking.
Yes, we've had music for every mood.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Charlie Higson and Friends on Scala Radio.
The Charlie Higson and Friends podcasts were originally broadcast on Scala Radio, a radio station that celebrates classical music in all its shapes and sizes. Why not join me, Charles Nove, for breakfast weekday mornings between 7 and 10? It would be wonderful to have you. Scala Radio broadcasts across the UK on DAB Digital Radio, on your smart speaker, the Scala Radio app, and online at scalaradio.co.uk.
Find the perfect space for your business with DRK & Company Realty. Flexible office suites are available. Employees and clients benefit from free parking, front door access, and walkable dining, retail, and hotels at the Polaris Lifestyle Center. Managed by DRK & Company Realty, one of Central Ohio's most trusted leaders, this safe, well-maintained property offers dedicated on-site management and responsive maintenance. Grow your business at an address designed for success at 470 Old Worthington Road. Visit drk-realty.com to learn more.